Hello, this is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare. I am so glad to be with you today. I'm standing in for the Voice of Liberty, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. Today is We the People Wednesday, and we're going to be celebrating, you and I, we're going to be celebrating freedom-loving people, people who stick to their guns. And that's exactly what they've been doing out in Nevada and now in Texas. We're going to be celebrating people who stand up to our lawless president and adhere to the United States Constitution. I'm very glad to say I'm going to be with you for the next 3 days, and we've got a lineup that is so exciting. I can hardly wait to tell you about it. Later today, we're going to have Congressman Steve King coming in to talk about what the House Judiciary Committee and the full Congress can do to rein in our lawless president. At 10 o'clock, we're going to be talking with John Fund about voter fraud, very relevant with this administration, in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking with one of the leading constitutional experts in the country, Seth Lipsky, about the outrageous efforts of New York's mayor, Bill de Blasio, to halt the NYPD's efforts to detect Muslim terrorism. So we've got a lot going on today, and tomorrow, even more. Tomorrow's going to be Liberation Thursday. We're going to be talking with Ambassador John Bolton, and get his insights on the growing crisis in the Ukraine and the perils of President Obama's policy of American weakness and apology. And we're going to be looking closer to home tomorrow at one of the key midterm election races, the efforts to unseat Governor Daniel Malloy of Connecticut. I don't know whether you've heard of Dan Malloy, but he has eviscerated Second Amendment rights in Connecticut. He's driven jobs out of Connecticut. He's kowtowed to the public unions and taxed the middle class to the bone. So we'll be hearing about the efforts of his opponents to liberate Connecticut from Malloy oppression. So we've got a lot ahead. But I have to tell you, I couldn't resist starting today with the story out west, where Americans have really stuck to their guns against the efforts of federal agencies, and particularly the Federal Bureau of Land Management, to drive them off the land and end their rural way of life. This is an incredible story, and it's a lot bigger than one cowboy, Cliven Bundy. In fact, there was a summit last weekend of governors and senators and members of Congress from 9 Western states. It had actually been planned before this showdown between Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy and the Bureau of Land Management sharpshooters. The key here is this. Rural residents throughout the Western United States are literally being forced to live like, let me put it this way. If a giant country, a giant militaristic country, had moved into a little third world country and started telling the local residents of that country how they could use the land, how they could live, the left wing would be calling it colonial oppression. But that's exactly what's going on in the West, where the federal government owns over half the land. In fact, in Nevada, where this one standoff recently occurred, the federal government owns 81% of the land. And as ranchers out there have said, this is a lot bigger than Cliven Bundy. Now, he may have decided not to pay his range grazing fees or his fines for grazing on land that the know-it-alls in Washington, D.C. wanted to reserve for a possibly going extinct desert tortoise. But the people out there rallied to Bundy's side, not because they support lawlessness, but rather because they can see that this federal agency is trying to end their way of life. It was shocking to me, but not to John Fund, who will be our guest later, to see the Bureau of Land Management show up, not in their go-to-court finery and briefcases ready to sue Bundy. Oh, no. They showed up with weapons. It was a SWAT team, literally. This from a president who draws a line in Syria and then it turns pink right away, who won't stand up to the Iranians as they're developing nuclear weapons, but sends armed militia to the West, literally to point guns at our own American citizens. And some of the things they did made me even question whether they really care about animals. I mean, one of the conflicts here is that Cliven Bundy has been grazing his cattle on land that the Bureau of Land Management decided must be cleared of cattle so that the almost extinct desert tortoise, a little tiny critter with four legs, can range, graze, do whatever a little almost extinct turtle does without being hassled by the cattle. But it makes you wonder whether these Bureau of Land Management folks have any respect for other animals. For example, at one of the town meetings out there, another one of the ranchers, Charlie Childer, said, well, when the feds came in to drive Bundy's cattle off the range, it was calving time. And next to these cattle were standing little doggy calves, some of them a day old, some of them a week old. But the Bureau of Land Management guys came right in and separated these new doggy calves from their mamas, drove the mamas way far away, and left these little doggy calves with no way to feed, just to die on the range. As Charlie Childer said at one of the town meetings, it makes you wonder, don't they consider that a little doggy calf is created by God too? Is it only the tortoise that deserves to be saved? You know, I took a closer look at this, and if anybody from the Pacific Northwest is listening, you'll probably remember this. Way back in the 1990s, the Forest Service decided to be equally heavy-handed. They went into the Pacific Northwest, and in an attempt, turns out it was a vain attempt, to save the spotted owl, they halted lumbering on a vast swath of the Northwest. Now, it turns out that their scheme didn't work because another kind of owl moved in that had better predatory skills and supplanted the spotted owl. That's what often happens in nature. It's Darwinian, as we call it. But nevertheless, the damage had been done. Timber mills were closed. Thousands and thousands of people in the Pacific Northwest lost their livelihood, their way of life. But that's okay. The people in Washington, they decided they knew best. They were going to run things their way. And that's exactly what's happening out west. In fact, now the Bureau of Land Management is moving into Texas and doing it again. You know, there's another side to this. They were treating Cliven Bundy's cattle as trespassers on federal land. Cliven Bundy was breaking the law. He was grazing his cattle where they didn't belong. But, you know, this kind of determination to enforce the law at all costs, it's very selective. The federal government isn't enforcing the immigration laws. When illegal immigrants are running across the land, they don't want to stop them. But when Cliven Bundy's cattle are running across the land, oh, that's when the Bureau of Land Management gets out their guns. Now, what about Lois Lerner? They're not going to enforce any perjury laws against her, right? Nope. It's selective rule of law. That's the rule in the Obama administration. Rule by lobbyists. It's the environmentalist, and I'm a great respecter of the environment. I love it. I spend my free time gardening and enjoying sunsets. But these environmentalists in Washington, they're not doing it for the little critters. They're doing it for the big bucks involved. And the human critters are taking it on the chin for this. One lesson that we learned from the Cliven Bundy standoff: Americans have a lot to gain by sticking to their guns. What if the local ranchers hadn't had guns? What kind of a standoff would it have been then? No standoff at all, because these federal agencies are now armed like militia. As I said, they don't go to court anymore. They come out with all kinds of weapons. And it's not just the Bureau of Land Management. When we get back, we're going to be talking more about this, and we're going to get ready to talk with one of the nation's constitutional experts, Seth Lipsky. But just keep this in mind: the proliferation of paramilitary federal SWAT teams reminds us of the importance of the Second Amendment. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York, author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction.
The Laura Ingraham Show. Call the Laura Ingraham Show, 1-855-40-LAURA.
Welcome back, Bubba. Glad you stayed with me. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the great Laura Ingraham, the great voice of liberty. And I'm so glad you stayed with us, because we have a bit more to talk about with this standoff between the Westerners. It's not just Cliven Bundy, the Westerners and the federal agencies. And we've got Arlene from Michigan on the line. Arlene? Well, she'll hop back in the saddle in a minute. In the meantime, what I wanted to explain is it's hard for Easterners to really get it. I mean, after all, in Connecticut or New York, the federal government owns less than 1% of the land. They're not calling the shots. But imagine living in a state where the feds own 81% of the land. They can decide just on their own, well, we're not going to fix this road anymore, so you can't drive to the town you've always done your shopping in or visited your relatives in, because we've decided that that road shouldn't be there anymore. That's the situation that people in the West are facing. And to make it worse, these agencies, as I said before, are fully armed. They're not just negotiating in court. They're throwing their weight around in a very frightening way. Let me give you a couple of examples. And these are from an article that John Fund, who will be with us later, wrote. I was astounded at some of these examples. One of them is the case of Kenneth Wright of Stockton, California. By the way, almost half of California is owned by the federal government. He was visited with a SWAT team, believe it or not, from the U.S. Department of Education. Who would ever think that the Department of Education has a paramilitary? But under Barack Obama, it does. And these agents battered down the door of his home at 6 in the morning, dragged him outside in his boxer shorts, handcuffed him, put his three kids, ages 3, 7, and 11, in a police car, right, for almost 2 hours, while they searched his home looking for his estranged wife, Michelle, who was suspected of college financial fraud. How can people have any rights when federal agencies are behaving like that? Here's another one. This one is a raid by the SWAT team from the Food and Drug Administration, right? They raided the farm of Dan Allegor in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And here was his crime. He was shipping unpasteurized milk across state lines to a cooperative of young women with children in Washington, D.C., who wanted to feed their families with raw milk. Right. Can you imagine? Now, maybe he was breaking the law, but take the guy to court. You don't show up with assault weapons, which is what these federal agencies are doing. It makes, as I said before, it makes the issue of gun rights so much more immediate and real. And of course, they're under assault in so many states. But it came as a real surprise to me that one of the most important gun rights cases is coming out of New Jersey. It's Chris Christie versus the NRA. And it all started with a man named John Drake, an elderly New Jersey retiree, who bought 50 ATM machines. He was just going to manage them for income, but one of his jobs was to fill them with cash. And because he had to carry thousands of dollars of cash around with him, he applied for a handgun permit in 2010. New Jersey, believe it or not, turned him down. This is a man who had no criminal record of any sort. They turned him down. He's taking his case to the Supreme Court, demanding his Second Amendment right to bear arms. And with him in this court case is the NRA and 19 states' attorneys general, as well as several think tanks. But what's really important here is that these state attorney generals realize that what's at stake in New Jersey is at stake all around the country, because the anti-gun groups are claiming that the right to bear arms means only at home, not the right to carry a gun outside of your home. Well, that wasn't going to help John Drake when he filled his ATM machines. And, you know, when I took a look at some of these arguments, what really puzzled me is it's the right to bear arms. If the term only applied to inside your home, you wouldn't be bearing arms, maybe possessing arms, but not bearing them. That word connotes going outside of your home. And moreover, of course, the right was originally within the context of serving in a militia, something you don't find in your kitchen very often. A militia. So New Jersey, it's the New Jersey state government versus John Drake and the NRA. One thing it does, of course, is call into question some of Chris Christie's credentials as a presidential candidate. We'd like to hear what Governor Christie says about this lawsuit, since he appears to be on the anti-gun side of it. That's another bridge for him to cross. So when we get back, we're going to be talking with Seth Lipsky, constitutional expert, on the efforts of the radicals in New York to take away the effectiveness of the NYPD. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the great Laura Ingram, your healthy radio addiction.
Call Laura now, 1-855-40-LAURA.
Welcome back, friends. It's Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the Voice of Liberty, Laura Ingram. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingram Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. We are celebrating the 125th anniversary this month of the launching of the greatest framework of government ever created by the hand of man, the United States Constitution. And as Benjamin Franklin said, as that document was about to be finalized, it's a republic if you can keep it. And never have we been quite as challenged to keep it as we are now under the current lawless administration. I've invited a real expert, Seth Lipsky, to join us now. He's the author of The Citizen's Constitution, An Annotated Guide, the founder and publisher of The New York Sun. And he's going to talk with us, among other things, about what appears to be a very misguided effort at political correctness. In a city, our city, New York City, that has stopped at least 16 terror plots since 9/11, and yet the current mayor, Bill de Blasio, wants to halt the NYPD's efforts at assessing where jihadists may be hiding or lurking. Welcome, Seth.
Thank you, Betsy. Nice to be with you.
So tell us a little bit more about this, because you wrote a really terrific column for the New York Post on what changes are going on in the NYPD.
Well, the column you're referring to was on the occasion of the disclosure, first by the Times and then by the city government itself, that it was disbanding a special squad that kind of cased the parts of the Muslim community where terrorists arriving in New York might try to blend in. I think everybody who's looked at this question wants to ensure, and this is a point was made by George Bush and President Obama, both presidents, that we're not at war with all Muslims.
Of course.
At war with, you know, the terrorists. And the NYPD under Commissioner Kelly had been very assiduous in finding out and keeping tabs on what was going on in the Muslim community. The new police commissioner under the new mayor has disbanded that squad. So that's what I wrote about it. But to me, the most interesting case was the one in New Jersey where a group of Muslims went into federal court and sought to sue the city of New York and the police department of New York for its spying on the Muslim community in New York. And they landed before a judge called William Martini, who I later wrote should get a Pulitzer Prize for common sense.
I agree.
He said, in effect, that, you know, this surveillance could not have been motivated by bias or bigotry because it didn't start until September 11, 2001. Or right after that. And therefore, it had to be connected to the attack on the United States. And it had nothing to do with bias. And he threw the case out of court. But he also said, in fact, nobody in the Muslim community knew they were being surveilled until the story was broken by the Associated Press. And it was not the New York Police Department which broke the story to the Associated Press. It was the Associated Press digging around with other sources and giving these facts and making these facts public of an undercover police investigation and putting its own interpretation. So he suggested, in effect, that maybe they ought to sue the Associated Press.
A good idea.
It was an astonishing moment. Particularly because the Associated Press series that he was talking about won the Pulitzer Prize.
A serious moment and an astonishing moment and yet a little bit tongue-in-cheek. But the point is that this wasn't hundreds of police officers sitting in mosques around the city. This was 16 people, right, who would focus on a bookstore or a coffee shop that tended to attract the kind of extremists where the terrorists might go when they arrived in this country. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, one of the great examples is the Boston Marathon bombing, which turned out to be the work of some brothers who had gone over to the Islamic terrorist cause. And after they committed that bombing, they fled to Cambridge, Massachusetts, where they murdered an officer of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Police, and then they hijacked a car and fled to Watertown, where they were stopped by the local police.
But they were headed to New York.
Exactly. They were headed to New York. So the fact is that the New York Police Department would have had a radically easier time keeping track of them or finding them once they got here because of the surveillance work they had been doing.
In other words, they would have known where to look for these two guys.
Yeah, okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, great. They would have known where to look for these two guys. It wouldn't have been a choice of, well, any block in the city. They would have known the particular places where people of that persuasion, and I'm not talking about the Muslim religion, but the jihad persuasion, would hang out.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So
and so, you know, New York has stopped this program. The new administration insists it won't be more exposed, but it's, you know, Ray Kelly got us through 12 years without any successful attacks and having foiled quite a number of attempts.
Well, one of the questions that came to my mind was whether Bill de Blasio reached this politically correct stand by himself or whether he's kowtowing to the Obama administration's full-scale retreat from what used to be called the War on Terror.
You know, it's a fabulous question, but I don't know the answer to it. And I haven't seen anything on it, but, you know, I don't know that the de Blasio administration needs any leftward nudging. It's a pretty left-wing administration.
That's right. Any farther left, they would have fallen off the page. I have a question for you on another topic, Seth, and that is, you are such a constitutional expert and revere the Constitution as I do. Have you taken a look at this recent effort? It appears to be driven mostly by Democrats, although Chris Christie has climbed on board in New Jersey, to rig the presidential election by defanging the Electoral College. In other words, states are ceding their ability to cast their electoral votes as the people of their own state determine and pledging to cast the electoral votes of their state as the national public vote determines.
Well, this is an amazing story, and I'm so glad you brought it up. And it's very hot right here in New York this week. This is something called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, and it's an agreement between states that binds them to cast their electoral votes in the presidential election for whichever candidate wins the national popular vote, irrespective of how the state voters went in their own state. And this compact will take effect when enough states have signed it to account for 270 Electoral College votes. It doesn't dismantle the Electoral College.
No, but it takes away the meaning
of
it.
But it makes a compact. So what happened last week is that Governor Cuomo signed the
of New York, right? Andrew Cuomo of New York.
Yes, Andrew Cuomo of New York. A Democratic liberal governor signed this measure, making New York the 10th state to have signed it, and it's now 61% of the way toward its goal of 270 electoral votes. So far, all the states that have ratified this compact are states that vote Democratic.
New Jersey's on that list, however. New Jersey is on that list.
Right.
New Jersey, Connecticut, California, New York, right.
Maryland. Connecticut hasn't done it yet, but is expected to be the next one.
Oh, I see.
But the point is, something amazing did happen in New York State that is causing people to just say, what's going on here? The New York State Senate is controlled by the Republicans, and it approved this pact 57-4.
Oh, it's so shocking.
It is just a stunning development. And not only did it do that, but the Conservative Party in New York, which you know is headed by Mike Long, not only endorsed it, it campaigned for it, and it scored it, meaning it really wanted the politicians it's watching to support this measure. So I called Mike Long and said, what's going on? And it is his wager that the conservative cause will be better served in a popular vote than in the Electoral College. Now, I have been against it, but I was struck by that. So then I called Joseph Griffo, a state senator from Rome, New York.
Seth, I'm just going to say right now, I'm going to keep you over after the break if you're willing, because this story is so important and we're going to hit a hard break soon. Go ahead, but in a moment,
okay. Okay, great.
This is so important because, to me, no matter which party it serves in the immediate future, it is the antithesis of what our Constitution intended, right? It is.
Yes.
It defeats the balance of powers, the checks and balances built into our system to give every geographical area of the country a reasonable voice in the selection of a national leader.
Yes, I mean, it is definitely tinkering with the delicate mechanism of the Constitution. Now,
I would use the word not tinkering. I would say rigging the system or defiling it.
I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean,
that's a great place to break for a second. Seth, wait with me until after the break. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. Your healthy radio addiction, 855-40-LAURA. Give us your thoughts. Are you willing to see the Electoral College and the U.S. Constitution just dragged out of this country?
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Welcome back, Bubbleheads. Betsy McCoy standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. And joining me is Seth Lipsky, author of The Citizen's Constitution, an annotated guide, very appropriately because we are celebrating the 125th anniversary of the launching of the federal government. 120th anniversary of the launching of the federal, 225th anniversary of the launching of the federal government under our great United States Constitution. Never has our Constitution been so threatened by the administration of the current president. But we're talking with Seth about an effort, I would call it rigging the Electoral College. Some call it Electoral College reform, using that word very loosely. Right now, in all but two of the states, it's the winner-take-all system. Whichever is the winner of the popular vote within that state is granted the electoral votes of that state. But under a new compact that more and more states are joining, New York State just became the 10th state, states would no longer award their electoral votes reflecting what their own citizens prefer, what their own voters choose, but in fact, according to the national popular vote. And Seth was telling us his thoughts on this.
Well, what I was saying, Betsy, was that I was startled that it passed the Republican-controlled Senate in New York State by such a wide margin of 57-4.
Is it ignorance? Was it ignorance?
Well, no, it's, well, you can make that decision.
I've been there.
Right. So, yeah, you have. You presided, right? So I am called Joe Griffo, who is a senator, a Republican from Rome, New York, and he led the effort to get this ratified in the New York Senate. And his bet is that conservative causes will fare better under this system than under the traditional system and under the system the founders intended. So,
but how can that be, Seth? Because the red states are primarily states in the middle and western part of the country that have a disproportionate influence in the Electoral College because they get the votes of their two senators plus their congressional reps.
Right. What he says, I'm not necessarily endorsing this. I'm not endorsing it. But what he says is that, and what Mike Long, the conservative leader, also says, is that the way it works now is conservative voters or Republican voters in New York have no voice in the national election. They are taken for granted. No one comes to New York to campaign. And so however many votes are cast for Republican in New York, in effect, go to waste. If it were a national popular vote, they would add into the popular vote. In 2004, George Bush won the popular vote, and New York would have cast its electoral votes for George Bush, even though John Kerry won in New York State by 18 percentage points. So,
well, that's an interesting proposal, but that's an interesting thought. But the demographics of the nation are changing rapidly. I'm going to wrap this up, Seth. It is such a privilege to have you with us. Glad you're still with us, friends. It's Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingram. You can reach us at Ingram Angle. You can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com or at 855-40-LAURA. That's 855-40-LAURA. And joining us now is one of the sharpest investigative reporters and thinkers in the nation, John Fund. And we're going to cover voter fraud, yesterday's landmark Supreme Court decision, and how to deal with the president whom most people in the nation, most people, a vast majority, consider to be a perpetual liar. So, John, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you, Betsy.
You have developed a reputation over the years as the expert on voter fraud, something that's very relevant under the Obama administration. Tell us how you got into it.
Well, actually, it started when I was a freshman in college, and I had a term paper to do covering elections. And so there was a recount for a state assembly race in California. I went down and watched the recount. And you know what? I witnessed voter fraud during the recount with my own eyes. And people always ask me, well, why didn't you report it to the authorities? And I said, well, it was the authorities that were committing the voter fraud.
Right. So it is. And in this.
So when you see something with your own eyes, it changes your perspective.
Yeah. And exactly how were they doing it? What did you see with your own eyes?
Back then, it was a low-tech operation. And what they would do is they would have these temporary workers counting the ballots. And these temporary workers would put a piece of pencil underneath their fingernail. And as they were recounting the ballots, let's say they'd have a ballot with a candidate that they didn't like come in front of them. They would take their fingernail and run it over the ballot, which was filled out with pencil. It was one of those optical scan things, and create another pencil mark, which when it was recounted would declare the ballot invalid. In other words, they were invalidating votes.
Oh, that's very interesting. So keep an eye out for the lead under the nail.
Yes. And by the way, California has not changed in its lack of transparency on this subject. California is the only state in the country that doesn't that mandates that you cannot ask people for photo identification at the polls. But in California, they're requiring photo ID for all people who want to see the new electronic voting machines that they're buying, want to see them tested. So it's completely ridiculous. You're prevented from asking for photo ID to vote, but if you want to see how the actual machines are done and to actually test them before they're put into use, you have to show a photo ID.
Wow, that's very interesting.
It's blatant hypocrisy.
More than that, I've got another example from California that I uncovered over a year ago, but it was just written up again this week, and that is what California is doing with its Obamacare money. California got about $910 million from the federal government to encourage people to come out and sign up for Obamacare. And they dispense that money to community organizations, right?
Of course.
Planned Parenthood, the AFL-CIO, all organizations closely allied with the Democratic Party. Now, the California legislature did two things. They immediately passed a law saying that voter registration must be an integral part of the Obamacare-covered California exchange, right? Voter registration
right.
has to be a part of it. And secondly, they passed a law saying they could keep secret what they did with the money.
Well, you know, since it's just been a few years ago that one of the California Secretaries of State had to resign from office because of misappropriation of discretionary funds under his control, it sounds like they're cruising for another bruising.
Right. Well, I don't know whether they'll get a bruising, though, from this Department of Justice. But in one of your recent articles, you pointed out a very interesting case in North Carolina.
Well, one of the problems we have is the sheer incompetence and sloppiness of our voting rolls. Federal law, the motor voter law, makes it very difficult for states to remove people from the voter rolls if they've died or moved away or haven't voted for several elections. So a lot of states have what there's called deadwood, people who don't belong in the rolls but are there. And let's say you move out of state. Well, it's pretty easy if you wanted to commit voter fraud to simply vote an absentee ballot, let's say in North Carolina where you used to live, and then vote a ballot at the polls where you are, or vote another absentee ballot in somewhere else. North Carolina is part of a 28-state consortium where they compare their voting records with each other. And North Carolina had ran the traps, and they found 36,000 people with the same name, complete name, same date of birth, same address, original address, who had voted in North Carolina as well as another state. Now, we can't prove yet that they had voted twice, but it certainly is what we call a clue in political science that something amiss is happening.
Now, you said nearly 36,000 voters, and as I recall, Barack Obama carried North Carolina by only 14,000 votes in 2008.
In 2008, yes.
So,
no, and seriously, I mean, we have a senator in Washington right now named Al Franken who may be there illegitimately because think what happened in 2008 when he ran for Senate. He defeated Norm Coleman, the Republican senator, after 6 months of recounts by 311 votes. And after all the recounts were finished, months later, a private group compared voting records, and they found that 1,200 felons had voted illegally in the election. Now, we can't be certain how the felons voted, but when Fox News went out and did a poll of them, it found 90% of them voted for Al Franken. Well, if that's the case, Al Franken's victory margin is in question. And, you know, that had serious consequences for you, your subject, Betsy.
Oh, yeah.
Because we all know Obamacare only passed with 60 votes because the Democrats had 60 votes to break a filibuster. If they had 59, we wouldn't have had the Obamacare bill we ended up with. We would have had a substantially different and less onerous Obamacare bill. So Obamacare may have resulted from an election that was conducted and certified illegitimately.
That's very interesting. But nothing can be done about that now?
No. Because
not about Obamacare, clearly, but I'm talking about the outcome of the race.
The Constitution provides the Senate is the sole judge of the fitness of its members to serve, and Harry Reid is not interested in this subject.
Wow. That's very sobering. Well, now, slightly related to this is the poll number that really struck me when I saw it. This was a Fox poll, and they found that 61% of Americans think that the president lies habitually.
Well, you know, I think politics is a complicated business. I'm very careful about using the word lie. So I would say, let's substitute engages in an alternate conceptualization of reality.
Like you can keep your doctor if you like your doctor.
Or I'm drawing a red line in Syria and I will not let anyone cross it.
Right. Well, that's a little different because, you know, he may have lost guts or determined that there was nothing he could actually do. That's poor judgment to say that. But when you say again and again, some 26 times, you can keep your health plan if you like your health plan, period, doesn't that comes closer to just plain lying?
Well, he certainly knew that wasn't the case because his own Department of Health and Human Services.
Very good, John.
His own Department of Health and Human Services had issued a report saying, well, of course Obamacare's new stringent requirements on insurance policies are going to mean millions of people are going to lose their coverage. So the only excuse Obama has, which is a very weak one, is claiming, I guess, that in his administration, his left hand doesn't know what his extreme left hand is doing.
Right. Or when he says preventive care is free, it's not free. You've paid for it up front in your premium. Or when he promises that people will save $2,500 on their health plan when he knows that's simply not true. But let's get on. I promise I won't use the word lie again. I'll say prevaricate, exaggerate, stretch the truth. What does that do? Make stuff up. What does that do fundamentally to our elective system, our representative government?
Well, I have a new book coming out with Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation in June. It's called Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder, and the Justice Department. I think our whole constitutional separation of powers and our rule of law are in jeopardy, because unlike any president since probably Richard Nixon, Obama and his attorney general have basically trampled over the rule of law. They've made stuff up. They've created powers out of thin air. Look at Obamacare, which you're such an expert on, Betsy. What is it now, 26 times they have literally changed the law without consulting Congress, without asking for anyone's oversight or permission?
That's right.
This is a Swiss cheese law now, in which the actual original law is the cheese, and the holes are so big, it's barely cheese anymore.
That's right. It bears very little resemblance to the actual law. What we see rolling out now bears very little resemblance to the actual law. But unfortunately, it's not even just in the area of health care. What about immigration policy, where he selectively enforces the laws, or environmental policy, where he imposes regulations that the Congress has already rejected?
Or the minimum wage, where he basically says if you work as a government contractor or get any kind of business from the government, we're going to force you to pay a higher minimum wage than your state allows.
Yes. Or, and you probably have a very good sense of this one, the IRS scandal, where the IRS targeting it may or may not lead to the White House.
Betsy, you know from the president's own words that there is not a smidgen, not even a smidgen
of a
suggestion of corruption in the IRS scandal. So obviously it's time for us to move along, because those aren't the agents you're looking for.
That's right. We've got to shift the debate, as the president said just the other
day. Speaking of shifting the debate, that is really what's going on right now with all of these called issues of mass distraction. Because when you have a sputtering economy, foreign policy reversals, Obamacare getting worse and worse, obviously you want to change the subject. So what the administration is doing, Betsy, is very simply they're calling the Republicans racist with very little pretext at all. They're basically declaring that they're fighting a war on women, such that the liberal female columnist of the Washington Post said they're engaged in shameless demagoguery. Anything to distract from the real issues and rile up their base, get them agitated so that they will turn out to vote in November. Because the biggest fear the Democrats have is, like 2010, their voters are dispirited, they're disappointed with Obama, they won't vote, and the Republicans will take back the Senate and probably build on their majority in the House.
On that very positive note, John Fund has promised that he's going to stay with us after the break and talk about the Supreme Court decision that came out yesterday. It's really very important. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction, 855-40-LAURA.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Glad you stayed with me, Bubba. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And we are speaking with one of the nation's premier experts on voter fraud and presidential elections, elections in general, but particularly presidential elections. And we're going to talk with him also about this new U.S. Supreme Court case that was decided yesterday. But before we get to that, John, I wanted to pick your brain on this effort to circumvent the Electoral College.
The National Popular Vote Scheme.
Yes.
Well, once again, this goes back to what we discussed in the last segment about just avoiding the rule of law. If you want to change the Constitution, which set up the Electoral College, you change the Constitution. You don't do an end run around the Constitution with this sneaky conspiracy in which a bunch of states will conspire and agree that they will cast their electoral votes for the winner of the national popular vote. I think we've had 6 or 7 states sign up for this.
10 now. New York just became the 10th state.
I don't think it's formally law in more than 7 or 8.
I think New York
just joined them. So I believe that this is disastrous, because not only would it mean that a lot of states would never see a presidential candidate, because obviously you'd only campaign in the cities and the major metropolitan areas because that's where the votes are, but it would be an open invitation to voter fraud, because at least with the current system of 50 different elections,
for the Electoral College, you can contain voter fraud or voter irregularities into basically one state or two states. Mm-hmm. Look what happens in 2000. Remember all that fighting we did over Florida?
Yes.
We took 6 weeks to figure out who had won Florida. Imagine if we did a national popular vote and we'd had to recount the whole country instead of just one state.
Well, that's a good point, but I think the most important point you made is that this is an effort to end run the Constitution. For many years, critics of the Electoral College have tried to get some interest drummed up in changing it. And the fact is, the nation, I believe, wants to stay with the Electoral College because it gives every part of the country an opportunity to have a voice in the selection of the president. And it's deliberately non-proportional. In other words, states with somewhat less population have somewhat more voice than they would in a national popular election, because we are a broad and diverse nation.
Absolutely. And I think that this is once again people who fear that they can't win by the existing rules. So rather than change the rule book, they want to upset the game of checkers, throw all the pieces on the floor and start over with rules of their own making.
Yeah, well, it's very discouraging. And it was particularly disheartening to me to hear from Seth Lipsky, who was on just a few minutes ago, that the Conservative Party and Republican parties in New York State are complicit in the efforts of New York to join this compact.
Well, as you know, Betsy, the New York Republican Party has a long, sordid history of getting into bed with liberals and basically having a headache the next morning and regretting it. And I think that this once again shows that New York Republicans, shall we say, they may be principled on Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, but be careful on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Right. Good point, John. Now, please tell our listeners about the United States Supreme Court decision yesterday.
That was a very important decision because what the court decided was
6-2,
yes, with Elena Kagan recusing herself because she had worked in the Obama Justice Department. I think the decision basically said the voters actually matter. The voters are sovereign, and if 58% of Michigan voters, which they did in 2004, say the state should not discriminate on the basis of race, that is a valid expression of popular will. What the plaintiffs, the people challenging Michigan's law against affirmative action and quotas, were saying is, well, the regents of the University of Michigan can make this change against affirmative action. The state legislature could, but the people themselves, through the initiative process, couldn't. It was a preposterous decision by the lower courts. The Supreme Court overturned it 6-2. And interestingly enough, though, in her impassioned 58-page dissent, Obama appointee Sonia Sotomayor sort of gave the game away that this issue was a loser for liberals because she whined in her opinion, well, you know, we used to call these special preferences for students in colleges and universities, we used to call them quotas, but that stigmatized them. Then we called it affirmative action, and now that's become stigmatized.
Yeah, they're looking for a new word for discrimination against...
A new euphemism. And the euphemism they've come up with is race
sensitivity
admissions
right.
policy.
Thank you very much,
and that
John.
That is a sure sign that they're losing the battle.
Right. It's been a pleasure to have you on. You're so insightful. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. Welcome back, friends. It's Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York and author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingram. And now I'm hoping that I can have a personal chat with you about a problem that is affecting so many of us, hospital infections. Believe it or not, hospital infections kill more people in our country each year than all the cases of AIDS, plus all the cases of breast cancer, plus all the car accidents combined. Can you imagine the death toll from hospital infections? Infections you get after you're in the hospital. And these infections are caused largely by unclean hands and inadequately cleaned equipment. That's right. Poor hygiene is responsible for most of these infections. And the reason I'm bringing this up right now, first of all, it's because it seems to be affecting all of us. If you have something you need to say about this, please give us a call, 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. But also because the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, part of the federal government, has held several press conferences, made numerous announcements in the last year about the dangers of hospital infections. But the emphasis, in their view, is all about the overuse of antibiotics. Now, that is part of the problem. And obviously, the overuse, misuse of antibiotics should be curbed. But from my point of view, and I've done a lot of research on this, I founded an organization called the Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths 10 years ago. So for 10 years, we've been on this, informing patients and families and hospitals on how to solve this problem. It's hard to know which is worse, the dying or the lying. And as John Fund explained before, maybe I shouldn't be using the word lying, maybe it's exaggerating, but the fact is, curbing antibiotics is only part of the answer. We need clean hospitals, clean healthcare. There is a hospital infection called C. diff. I know many people listening have had C. diff, or someone they love has had C. diff. This is an infection caused by poor hygiene. So when a doctor or a hospital staff member says, I'm sorry, your grandmother got C. diff because she's on antibiotics, don't believe it. It's not because she's on antibiotics. You can't get C. diff if that C. diff spore doesn't enter your mouth and get into your gastrointestinal system. And the way it happens is this. A patient's in a hospital bed, and those C. diff spores invisibly are contaminating literally all the surfaces in the hospital room, the bed rail, the over-the-bed table, the call button, the IV pole, the telephone. And grandma reaches out and she touches the bed rail. She picks up those invisible C. diff spores on her hands. And then her meal tray is delivered. And she picks up her brownie or her apple or a sandwich and eats it without cleaning her hands first. Nobody in the hospital has offered to clean grandma's hands, right? So she ingests that C. diff spore, and that's what causes C. diff. Now, if she's on antibiotics, it makes her more vulnerable to the severe symptoms of C. diff, rampant diarrhea. But it's swallowing that spore that gives her C. diff, and swallowing it is the result of inadequate cleaning in grandma's hospital room. The fact is, hospital rooms are literally covered in invisible bacteria even after the patient is discharged and the next patient is being put in the room. In fact, a study was done recently by an expert, Dr. Philip Carlin at Boston University and his team. He looked at hospitals all the way from Boston to Washington, D.C., 1,100 hospital rooms, and he found that in those rooms, over half the surfaces that are supposed to be cleaned when one patient is discharged and before the next one is put in that room were overlooked by the cleaners. Same is true even in operating rooms. Over half the surfaces in the operating room that are supposed to be cleaned were left untouched by the cleaners. And it turns out, based on the latest research, that the number one risk of getting a hospital infection is not how old you are or the diagnosis you came into the hospital with. It's what room you're put in. In other words, if you're placed in a room and a preceding occupant had a hospital infection or was carrying one of these deadly superbugs, you're at much higher risk of getting it because when that patient left, the room wasn't adequately cleaned. That's the sad story about it. And the fact is, there are several ways to solve this problem, but hospitals simply haven't done it. One way is to wipe all the surfaces with bleach. In fact, there's a doctor out at the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Robert Ornstein, and he conducted a very important study that showed that wiping all the, quote, high-touch surfaces, those are the things the grandma and the doctor and the nurse touch all the time, wiping those surfaces once a day with a Clorox bleach wipe reduced C. diff, this deadly infection, by 79%. So why isn't every hospital doing that? Instead of swabbing the floor, I've never seen the doctor roll the patient up and down the floor. Instead of swabbing the floor, let's devote those those man hours to wiping the surfaces right around the patient's bed with a bleach wipe to remove these deadly bacteria. There are also some very effective high-tech solutions, hydrogen peroxide misters, UV light. They literally eradicate the bacteria in a room in between patients, but hospitals aren't using them. And we need a real nudge from state and federal authorities. Here's one place where regulation could actually save lives instead of just causing people a lot of SORUS. Here's one place where the federal government or state government should step in and say every patient deserves a clean hospital room, but it's not being done. And that's why hospital infection is the fourth largest killer in the United States. Imagine, right behind heart disease, stroke, cancer. Number four, hospital infection. Infections that are preventable through proper hygiene in hospitals. If you want to weigh in on this subject, 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. As you know, healthcare is very close to my heart. I founded RID 10 years ago when I was Lieutenant Governor of New York. I saw so many people affected by hospital infection that I vowed when I left office that that's what I was going to do. We've got Paul from Indianapolis on the line. Paul, what's on your mind?
Well, I've got two things for you. First of all, I'm an engineer that works in the exact area that you're talking about to try to eliminate these. And second of all, my father passed away from a combination of MRSA and VRE and some of the other types of conditions.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Acquired last September. And so I'm kind of passionate about it. And these can be eliminated, but the problem is you're getting down to basic cost and money. I've seen so many hospitals eliminate the resources that clean these areas that actually eliminate the biohazards and some of the other things for the sake of reducing costs, and actually it's increasing defects and reducing quality. And so really it's not affordable health care. It's actually cheap health care. And what ends up happening is, like, am I allowed to mention any organizations or not?
Oh, by all means, say anything you want, Paul.
There is an organization called HCA, Hospital Corporations of America. In a lot of cases, they're cutting costs by eliminating those resources that actually work on eliminating the waste, eliminating the infectious, and cleaning up the areas. Often is the case, I'll see overflowing biohazard bins in these hospitals where my father actually passed away. I took photographs of them. I gave it to the floor nurse, and basically they say, "Oh, we don't work in that. We don't work on those kind of things."
Isn't that a shame? But I'm sorry. Go ahead.
This was in an ICU unit in Florida, in Port St. Lucie, Florida.
Well, I'm glad you're telling us about this, although I'm very saddened by your father's death from a staph MRSA infection. The fact is, it's very short-sighted of the hospitals, because hospital infections add well over $35 billion a year in direct care costs. And even though the hospitals think they're saving money by cutting the environmental services staff, the cleaning staff, they're really not. Now that Medicare and private insurers refuse to reimburse hospitals for infections that could have been prevented, these infections are huge losers for the hospital. And one of the things that my organization does is to show hospitals that preventing infections not only saves lives, but also makes the hospital more financially secure, even in the short run.
There are some hospital systems, and I'll give you a real example. Over the past 2 years, I've been affiliated with the Institute of Industrial Engineers. We've been working with the Georgia Hospitals Association to train a lot of the registered nurses, the executives, and quite a few of the physicians in these areas of eliminating these defects and waste in hospitals. Now, some of those particular programs go unnoticed. And what we're finding out is that because of the cost-cutting unconsciousness, we're seeing an increase in cost because of all the litigation, because of all the issues, and because we're running 12-hour shifts on nurses who actually have to cover for some of these issues that are eliminated by trying to cut costs in the areas that are cheaper, and they're paying more for registered nurses to do things than they are for maybe three times as many people to actually clean the areas. Over.
I'm glad you raised that issue, too. You know, hospital infection is the next asbestos. You said litigation. It is the next major cause of class action lawsuits. There was a time when a family affected by hospital infection could do nothing. But now that we know hospital infections are preventable through proper hygiene, when someone in the family does die from a hospital infection, there's a lawsuit. And juries are now awarding damages to patients and families affected by hospital infection. So it's one more incentive for hospitals to clean up their acts. And I would just say to everyone listening, if you want to know more about how to protect yourself from a hospital infection, or what the infection rates are of the hospitals in your area, come to www.hospitalinfection.org. Go ahead,
now,
Paul.
Some of the physicians that I work with directly have advised me, and these aren't physicians just in Florida, just in Georgia. I've worked with physicians in California. I've worked with physicians in Arizona and other places around the United States. And they confidentially tell me, if you get sick, don't go to the hospital.
Well,
and
it
that's
is.
Where
it
the
is
worst
a,
case is.
That's right. It is a major risk. And in fact, in many hospitals, in the ICUs, particularly, more cancer patients die from infection than from the underlying cancer diagnosis. Hospital infection is a major, major risk. But we do want to make sure that families listening can do something about it. And one thing I say is, if you're going to the hospital to visit a loved one, don't bring candy, don't bring flowers. Bring a canister of bleach wipes and a pair of gloves, because just by wiping all those surfaces around the bed, the call button, the over-the-bed table, the telephone, all the surfaces that your loved one and the doctors and nurses touch frequently, you could be saving a life.
Now, the final point, and actually this might be beneficial to you,
Paul,
is,
if you can hold on till after the break, we're going to be hitting a break in a second, and I don't want to be rude and interrupt you. I'm very glad you called. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the Voice of Liberty, Laura Ingram. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction. If you want to talk to us about hospital infection, give us a call, 855-40-LAURA.
The Laura Ingram Show.
Glad you're joining me. It's Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the Voice of Liberty, Laura Ingram. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingram Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And I'm so glad that we have callers weighing in on this critical issue of hospital infection. Charlene from South Carolina, an XOR nurse. Glad you're calling in, Charlene.
Hi, Betsy. Glad to talk to you. Hey, Betsy, as a former operating room nurse, I think there ought to be a position actually within hospitals to look into this, to make sure that this is being done. It's not that big of a change. It's a change of chemicals, actually. And what's the big deal about wipes? We actually use them in the OR. They're very effective.
Right. And Charlene, I'm so glad. I'm so glad you're very articulate, and you said it well. It's a change of chemicals. Unfortunately, so many hospitals rely on quaternary ammonia instead of on bleach, and we know that the bleach kills C. diff and other superbugs. Well, C. diff's not a superbug, but kills C. diff,
yeah,
and superbugs. And so we should be using the most effective chemicals. You're absolutely right. And of course, hospitals have infection control positions, but they don't seem to be ahead of the curve. They're still behind the curve. And that's my problem with the CDC as well.
Well, also, at a school level, children ought to be taught. I know moms are great for using the antibacterial sanitizers and the hand soaps, but Betsy, you and I both know that that's not all that matters. As a matter of fact, that can cause problems. But at a different level, learning when to wash hands and when it is, I mean, shopping carts, you know what I'm talking about.
I do. I do. And
any
of course,
in a store.
The big difference is that when you're in a hospital, when you have a surgical incision or an IV or a ventilator, you're so much more vulnerable to these bacteria. It really becomes critical. But you put your finger on it again. It's when to wash your hands. And what I see again and again in the hospitals is doctors and nurses may clean their hands on the way into the room, but then they reach up and pull open the privacy curtain, and their hands are recontaminated because the curtain is so seldom cleaned.
Absolutely.
Thank you for calling, Charlene.
Thank you, Betsy. I love listening to you.
I'm so glad to hear from you. Manya from Georgia.
I have a very small concern, but it might be pretty big, and that is I notice around hospitals, the personnel all walk around in their scrubs, going home in them, coming to the hospital. My concern is, are these scrubs cleaned prior to going in to visit a patient or into the operating room?
I am so glad you called about this. We're taking a break in just a minute, but Manya, we are going to address this issue the minute we get back, and it's not just... are they cleaned on the way in? It's the dangerous bugs they're bringing out of the hospital, home to their own children, but also to the local deli, to the bus, wherever they're going. Thank you for raising that. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. It's your Healthy Radio Addiction. Glad to be with you. It's Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingram. And we've been talking about the scourge of hospitals, hospital infection. And Manya from Georgia just called to ask about hospital scrubs. And Manya, I am so glad you asked this question because it is a real concern. You see people walking around the hospitals, going into delis, getting on buses, all with their hospital garb on, right?
I have seen that for many years. Yes, you're right.
And the problem is not simply that they're going into the hospital carrying whatever they've picked up outside. That's not the big problem. The really big problem, Manya, is what they're bringing out of the hospital on their garments. The MRSA, the C. diff, the VRE, the gram-negative bacteria that they've picked up in the course of their job. Some of them go right home and pick up their children, make dinner with these garments on.
Well, I'm glad that we're able to bring that to light because it has been a concern of mine for many, many years. I drive by hospitals seeing the people standing outside taking their smoke break, coffee breaks, et cetera, and they're wearing these garments that they're going to be going in and tending to patients who are at risk.
And by the way, many of them don't even launder these garments daily. At the University of Maryland, a study was done of doctors' white lab coats. Mm-hmm. 65% of physicians admit they change that lab coat less than once a week. 15%,
but
15% admit they change it less than once a month. Can you imagine all the bacteria on that lab coat? It's like a map of every patient they've tended to.
And that's my concern. And I'm really glad that we were able to bring it to light with hope all of this that you're discussing does come to fruition because it's so serious that one now is recoiling if one has to go into the hospital. Am I going to come out alive or dead?
Right. I'm really glad you called about it. And let me just add, although I am seldom an advocate for British healthcare, they have a single-payer system that rations care and especially is hard on the elderly. In one area, they're moving slightly ahead of us, and that is they have mandated now that doctors and nurses wear short sleeves.
Yes, I've read about that.
They're called smart scrubs. And the reason is that you see doctors lean over a bed and that white sleeve touches a patient's incision or another part of a patient's body. It's a vector of disease. It carries bacteria from bedside to bedside. So sleeves are something that should be eliminated inside the hospital. Again, Manya, thank you so much for calling.
You're very, very welcome, and thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it, and I love the show. Thank you.
Oh, you're so sweet. And anyone who wants to come to hospitalinfection.org, we want to help. I founded this organization 10 years ago because, in my view, hospital infection is one of the most serious health problems we have, and yet it's totally preventable through proper hygiene and rigorous procedures, something lacking in many hospitals, even though doctors and nurses work very hard. We've got Brian from South Carolina, Myrtle Beach, a wonderful place, on the line about copper. Brian?
Yes, ma'am.
Are you calling about copper? It's my favorite metal because it prevents hospital infections.
Exactly. And that's my thought is why are we not using copper on these highly touched surfaces? Because it naturally creates such a hostile environment for bacteria that if you do miss a spot, you've got a much smaller chance of that bacteria being spread to someone else.
Well, thank you for that call. What you're saying is so important. And in fact, just recently, a study was done at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York and other hospitals demonstrating the copper-coated surfaces in the ICU dramatically reduce the incidence of infection. So you are right on to something important, and I hope we will see much more copper used, especially as new hospital wings are built and rooms are refitted. We've got Gil from New Hampshire on the line. Gil? Oh, maybe we lost him. Well, I hope he'll call back. One of the things that was brought up by Manya from Georgia is so important, and that is the soft surfaces in the hospital, the garments that people wear, like scrubs and white coats, but also the curtains. One of the most dangerous areas of a hospital room, believe it or not, is that privacy curtain that is pulled around the bed on a track, usually attached to the ceiling. Those curtains are seldom changed, and they are loaded with bacteria. And I see doctors and nurses come into a room, they clean their hands at the entrance to the room, but then they reach up and pull open that curtain and their hands are recontaminated just seconds before they reach the patient. And there's a way to solve that problem. There are several companies out there that make disposable privacy curtains. You don't even have to go all the way up to the track in the ceiling. It has a Velcro strip about forehead height, so you can change that curtain in about 38 seconds and eliminate a major source of hospital infection. Another one, believe it or not, is blood pressure cuffs. I don't know whether you've noticed, but they wheel that blood pressure cuff from room to room, bedside to bedside, and wrap it around one arm after another, often without cleaning it. And that, of course, they pick up the bacteria off one patient's arm and deliver it to the next patient. So that has to be stopped. Even EKG wires have been tracked to deadly infections in hospitals. There was a study in Galveston, Texas, in a burn unit where a patient became horribly infected because the EKG wires were carrying a bacteria called VRE, vancomycin-resistant enterococcus. So there is so much that we can do to improve hospital hygiene. I'm sure you've noticed this, too, if you've been in a hospital recently. When a patient does contract an infection, they put the patient in what they call isolation. Basically, that means they put a sign on the door, and then they require everyone going in and out to wear a gown and gloves, sometimes even a mask. But then when that patient is discharged from the hospital, they simply take the sign off the door. Well, too bad, because the bacteria are left behind. The patient has left, but the bacteria are still in that room, coating the surfaces, and not enough is done to those rooms where patients with infections resided before the next patient is admitted to that room. And that's where you, family members, can come into play. You're never given a choice of where your loved one is put, what room you're given, but you can certainly go in there with a canister of bleach wipes and clean it up yourself. I've done it several times for members of my family, and I have to say it's been extremely successful. I had one loved one in the hospital for 3.5 months with endocarditis, an infection of the hospital of the heart valve, and ultimately he had to get a new heart valve. But 3.5 months in the hospital with no infection. And I can tell you, I hate to take credit, but I was in there every day scrubbing every surface in that room. If a doctor came in and put his hands on the bed rail, the minute he left, I wiped that bed rail down with those Clorox bleach wipes again. So it really works. And I'd encourage you to be proactive and take those steps yourself. When you go up on our website, you'll see some other tips that are really, really important. For example, if you're going in for surgery, bathe yourself with a liquid soap called chlorhexidine for 2 or 3 days before your surgery. It will help remove dangerous bacteria from your own skin that could get into your surgical site infection and cause a big problem. Also, avoid shaving before you go into the hospital. Believe it or not, shaving your legs, your face, creates small nicks in your skin through which bacteria can enter. So shaving is particularly dangerous if you're going into the hospital. You want to avoid any of those incidental nicks. If you're going to have surgery, talk with your doctor about keeping you warm. Even though operating rooms are frigidly cold, they can keep you warm with warming blankets, booties, and a little cap on your head. And we know that patients who are kept warm seem to resist infection better. And remember, if you're going into the hospital to have a baby, the happiest of all reasons, I can say that because I'm a grandma. If you're going into the hospital to have a baby, remember, if you're having a cesarean, that's surgery too, and talk with your doctor about taking all the usual precautions to avoid a surgical site infection. Nothing would ruin that wonderful occasion of bringing a baby home from the hospital. Nothing would ruin it more than contracting a hospital infection on your way home. So those are some of the tips that you can find. And when I get back from the break, I'm going to be talking a bit about things you can do to protect yourself from Obamacare. For example, if you're a baby boomer, that means you're in your late 50s or early 60s, line up your doctors now. Line up a cardiologist. Line up an internist, even if you're healthy. Because if you wait till you're 65 and go on Medicare, you're not going to be able to find a doctor willing to take you on as a new patient. That's because cuts to Medicare pay for over half the Obamacare Affordable Care Act. Cuts to Medicare pay for over half of it. And so doctors are paid so little under the Affordable Care Act. Doctors are paid so little to take care of seniors, less than they're paid to take care of anybody else, that it's going to be increasingly hard to find a doctor willing to take you on as a new patient. We're going to be talking about more of those tips in a few minutes. Here's one more. If you care about privacy, and almost everybody who goes to the doctor does, because you confide things to your doctor you wouldn't tell anybody else, if you're going to talk to your doctor about something truly private, talk to your doctor about keeping two sets of books, because the financial incentives on doctors now are forcing them to enter all of your medical information into an interoperative electronic database that will be seen by thousands of eyes. Doctors won't be surprised by your question. They've taken the Hippocratic Oath to keep your information secret, and they will really understand your desire to do that. So this is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram, the voice of liberty. This is your healthy radio addiction. We'll be back after the break with more on your health care and a lot about politics and Congressman Steve King on what we can do to protect liberty and rein in our lawless president.
The Laura Ingram Show.
Glad you're with me. It's Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingram. And we were talking Obamacare, but the board has really lit up on the issue of hospital infection. And I like to give my callers a chance to speak and weigh in. And we have Marius from Florida.
Hi, I'm calling because I do agree with you completely about the fact that infections are being spread through many contacts, as somebody mentioned, the scrubs, but also things like the blood pressure cuff and the stethoscope. But my main point is that I don't agree with many doctors that say that antibiotics are overprescribed. They're prescribed appropriately. In fact, sometimes they're not prescribed enough because of the fear that some agencies have made the doctors be afraid to give antibiotics when it's appropriate. My belief from the research that's available in the journals is that antibiotics are not causing resistance to antibiotics. It's the improper use of antibiotics that's causing the resistance to antibiotics. If people are not taking the full course or taking it intermittently, that's when it can cause a problem where you don't kill off the particular germ that's attacking you, not the fact that you're taking the antibiotic.
This is such an important point, Marius. I'm really glad you weighed in with this. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
We're going to hear more and more from listeners about hospital infection, because it does affect literally so many people. And again, let me just repeat the website, hospitalinfection.org. We at the Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths want to help you. We want to prepare you before you go into the hospital, arm you with all the information you need to reduce your risk of a hospital infection. I was talking about Obamacare before the break, and I've been inundated with requests to give you more practical advice on what to do, how to avoid the landmines until we get rid of this very destructive law, which we will do. So one is to have a frank talk with your doctor about keeping two sets of books if you have confidential information you don't want thousands of eyes to see. Another, as I mentioned, is to line up your doctors if you're a baby boomer, because when you turn 65, it will be hard to get someone willing to take you on as a new patient. And another one is this. If you know you're going in for surgery, for example, for a knee repair or something that's elective, try to cobble together enough money for a private duty nurse, at least for the first night, because, as I said, cuts to Medicare pay for over half this law, and some of the biggest cuts are to what hospitals are paid. And the result is that hospitals are already laying off nurses and spreading the care thinner. And when you're in that bed, especially in the middle of the night, and you press that button for pain relief or help, you don't want to wait too long. So that's one way to protect yourself. In the meantime, there's been a lot in the news about Obamacare, and there are some huge changes ahead. But one of the most difficult things that people are finding is that they can't get a doctor anymore. I was just looking at this terrible case of Margaret Figueroa from New York. She's had four brain surgeries. Imagine surviving that. And now she signed up for Obamacare and suddenly discovered, even though she was told she had health coverage, the fact is her plan doesn't seem to cover anybody who can actually treat her. Her old doctors weren't available, and when you're in the middle of a neurological problem like she has, having to change doctors in midstream is a big enough problem. But when she tried to reach out to new neurologists who were on her plan, two of them were already booked up, and the others were so far away. And that's what so many patients are finding. For example, I was talking to people in New Hampshire the other day, where 10 out of 26 hospitals in the state were just excluded from the Obamacare plans. So literally, a mother has to drive right by the hospital she's always relied on for her children's care to go much farther away to a hospital that's included in these Obamacare exchange plans. So that's one of the biggest problems ahead, access to doctors and hospitals. You're told you have coverage, but you really don't. And for that, you're paying a much bigger premium than in the past. That's something we can talk about when we get back to bigger, much bigger premiums ahead. But let me also let you know that after the break, we're going to be talking with one of I regard him as one of the finest members of the United States Congress, Congressman Steve King from Iowa. He is on the House Judiciary Committee, and he's going to tell us about the practical steps that freedom-loving members of Congress are taking to try to rein in our lawless president. So this is Betsy McCoy standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction, 855-40-LAURA. Give us a call. Joining me, it's Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the Voice of Liberty, Laura Ingraham. And in a few minutes, we're going to be talking with Congressman Steve King from Iowa, who's a member of the House Judiciary Committee. But to tee this up, all of us, of course, are very concerned about the way this president has strayed from our Constitution, literally trampling it underfoot. He has exceeded the powers granted to a president under Article 2, Section 3. His obligation, his sworn duty, is to see that the laws are faithfully executed. But instead, as we've seen with Obamacare, he's made some 36 changes to the law, without most of them without the permission of Congress. He is simply ruled by fiat, something the president is not allowed to do. He's also ruled by waiver, in other words, granting 1,472 exemptions to parts of the law to certain unions, certain companies, but not to others. The same is true with other laws, not just with the Affordable Care Act. He has, for example, tried to do away with, dispense with, the work requirements in the 1996 welfare reform. He has selectively enforced the nation's immigration laws. He has imposed extremely costly, burdensome environmental regulations on companies, even when Congress refused to enact those same restrictions because of their cost and their job-killing nature. So we have a long list of offenses, but what can Congress do about it? That's what we'll be discussing with Steve King. Eric Cantor, one of the top dogs in the House of Representatives, just issued a 33-page report, which you can get yourself, www.majorityleader.gov. It is a 33-page recitation of the president's violations of the Constitution. That's enough to make anybody pause. It's also a discussion, however, of some of the things Congress can do to rein in this lawless president. For example, we've got Congressman King on the line now, so he can discuss them with us. I am proud and pleased to introduce one of my favorite members of the United States Congress because he is a true leader and lover of freedom, Congressman Steve King from Iowa.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on, Betsy. I had to disengage from another difficulty we're trying to solve in this country, so I'm coming in a couple minutes late, which I apologize for.
You are always worth waiting for. But tell us a little bit about the Faithful Execution of the Law Act and the Enforce the Law Act, because I know you're playing a leading role in trying to stop the lawlessness of this president.
Well, yes, and we've been looking at this, and there are a good number of members have come up with a series of different kinds of solutions, and we've held multiple hearings in the House Judiciary Committee. I commend Chairman Bob Goodlatte for holding some of the most important hearings that I have been involved in my time in Congress. But Tom Rice has a bill that it grants standing so that we can bring legislation and actually sue the president in court.
Okay, let's just explain to folks what that means. In other words, in the past, members of Congress, because of some Supreme Court rulings, haven't had, quote, standing, meaning they can't sue the president for violating the Constitution, right? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And you can have the sense of being aggrieved, and you know, we all take an oath to uphold the Constitution. The president does too. His oath it's implicit that he take care that the laws be faithfully executed. That's referred to as the take care clause. And so the president has an oath to follow this. He knows better. He's an adjunct, former adjunct law professor who taught constitutional law at the very respected law school, the University of Chicago School of Law. I've heard his lectures to high school students as to why he didn't have the authority to do the very things that he is assuming the authority to do. And so Congress has a few options on reining in a lawless president. And this is, remember, a president who has suspended immigration law, who suspended welfare to work, who suspended the No Child Left Behind, and who has 30 or more times changed Obamacare and multiple other pieces that probably missed my attention. This president has violated this Constitution so many times, I don't think there's a single person in America that can list them from memory. And so the tools that we have are, granted, within the Constitution, the spending authority of Congress is one, to be able to shut off the spending to limit where the dollars can be used by the executive branch / president. We tried that, and we went through the government shutdown beginning at midnight September 30th. It ended with the president having more power, not less, because too many members of the House decided they would cave in to his demands and grant him the money that he demanded to fund Obamacare.
Let me just stop right there and commend you and others who did try to use the power of the purse just the way James Madison told us to do it in Federalist 54. Use the power of the purse to discipline the president. You were right, and unfortunately some members of Congress didn't have the stomach to stick with it. Go ahead.
Well, thanks, Betsy. And also going into that, some of those members of Congress and Republican members planned and strategized and spoke to cave in. They wanted to cave in from the beginning, and that's eventually what happened. So there's another tool. It's a constitutional tool called impeachment that was used against Bill Clinton for his, let's say, indiscretions in the White House with an intern.
And the perjury counts, right.
Absolutely. Perjury, subordination of perjury, and obstruction of justice. Those things all went before the United States Senate for a trial. He was indicted by the House, impeached by the House, and then the United States Senate was to decide whether or not he was guilty of any or any combination of those three charges that I've listed and the question of whether he should be removed from office. That took a two-thirds vote. The Senate caved before they even got a verdict, simply by putting all three charges and the question of whether he should be removed from office all into one question. What is he or isn't he guilty of any one of these three, and should he be removed from office if he is or even if he isn't? Every senator got to characterize it any way they wanted. They dodged their constitutional responsibility. That sets a precedent. That's not a tool that's effective for us either. So then we look to the courts for resolution of this matter, and members of Congress don't have the standing as you've described, so we're trying to establish that standing by legislation so that a court can hear a case that's brought by a member of Congress or by a majority resolution of Congress. I actually think that we've got a legitimate shot at standing if we would pass a resolution and direct the Speaker of the House to bring suit against the President of the United States. I think it would be hard for a federal court to say, you don't have standing, you're not damaged, even though you're standing there in the shoes of 800,000 constituents for each one of us, and that some of these cases, you have a Republican who was elected to office representing people who had a Democrat who voted for Obamacare. I think that enhances a standing case if you have people like that, and I think it's worth testing it in court whether or not we get legislation passed to grant standing.
Well, I'm very heartened that you are taking this course of action, because you're quite right. When our members of Congress are deprived of the ability to make laws and make them stick because the president simply ignores them, refuses to execute them, and tries to assume the lawmaking power himself, we are all injured parties. We are all losing the right to self-government.
And Betsy, think of a constitutional structure that the absolute wisdom of our founding fathers that so carefully and well put together this Constitution with the three branches of government, there's a static tension between each of those branches. The line of power between them isn't absolutely clearly black and white, but it's closer than this president would have it be. And our founding fathers envisioned that the executive, legislative, and judicial branch would vie for that constitutional authority, and each branch would jealously protect the authority and power granted to it in the supreme law of the land. And they didn't anticipate that Congress would abdicate its responsibilities to assert constitutional authority. They didn't think that a Congress would just simply give it up and cave on a shutdown, as we saw, because they thought that that power would be more important and to keep it in the legislative branch than to cede it to the president. So we're in territory now that's not been explored in the history of this country, and I don't think our founding fathers, here's even the more important one. Our founding fathers wrote this Constitution in the era of dueling. If someone insulted your word or your integrity, we had some of our founding fathers that went out and faced each other down. Alexander Hamilton was killed in a duel, and Aaron Burr, not the most honorable, is the man who shot him. But these people that had that level of chivalry and honor could not imagine a president of the United States giving his oath of office to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution and take care that the laws be faithfully executed, while at the same time just simply lie to the American people about Obamacare and know that he's violating his oath to the Constitution with the many violations he's had that have gone through the list, Betsy. They are turning over in their graves at what's happening with the dishonor that's been brought upon the Constitution by this president, who knows he's breaking his oath and knows he's violating the Constitution. He does it with impunity because he's calculated that he can get away with it.
And because the party that supports him is allowing him to get away with it. I have to tell you how shocked I was, and I'm sure you shared this feeling, at the State of the Union message earlier this year when the president said he was going to use his pen and his telephone literally to make law when the Congress refused. And the Democratic members of Congress stood up and applauded at their own loss of authority.
Betsy, that image is forever burned in my mind. And, you know, when you have the privilege to be inside the House chambers during a State of the Union address, you get to see a perspective that they try to show you on television. I've watched State of the Union address for years, and it's something, it's idyllic to watch the momentous State of the Union addresses that have taken place over the years that I've had a chance to see it on C-SPAN or on television. But sitting inside, I learned quickly, be a student of who stands, who leaves the standing ovations, who sits down. And in this, you've seen this, and it is so many Democrats, and I might well have been all of them. They popped up. Some of them are seated among Republicans by directive of Nancy Pelosi. They popped up and tried to lead a standing ovation in the middle of that.
Yes.
It is, you applaud the destruction of the Article 1 authority in the Constitution that grants Congress, members of Congress, the authority to legislate. The president claimed it in front of them, and they cheered him.
It is really shocking. Well, it's a privilege to have you on, Congressman King, because you are carrying forward the banner for constitutionalism. Not enough members of Congress are taking their oath to defend the Constitution seriously, but you are. I wanted to get your thoughts on Mark Zuckerberg, but unless you can hold on till after the break, we won't be able to do that because we're hitting a break right now.
I could, Betsy.
Oh, good. Great. Okay, we'll be back after the break with some closing thoughts and an interesting anecdote about Congressman King. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction, 855-40-LAURA, and this is We the People Wednesday.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Glad you're with me, Bubba. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare 2014, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. And we were visiting with Congressman Steve King. I had one last question for the congressman. Zuckerberg versus King. I thought the billionaires were supposed to be for the right. Who is this? What's going on here?
Well, of course, Zuckerberg is the founder of Facebook. He's
right?
A multi-billionaire. He wants cheap IT labor. He wants to be able to import it from anywhere in the world anytime he wants in as big a numbers as he can so that he doesn't have to pay a competitive wage here in the United States. There are a lot of IT workers that have degrees in the country that are qualified, but he knows he can flood that market and cheapen his overhead costs. So he's decided to spend his money against me. It looks like a business investment. And they're running ads, or they bought ads at least in Iowa, television ads and apparently internet ads, attacking me because I'm standing up for the rule of law and defending our secure borders. And I think that multi-billionaires, because they're rich, shouldn't be setting policy in the United States. That's not necessarily a qualifier. So you've got Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, George Soros, you've got Google money, all of that lined up against me and others that defend the rule of law. But I'm their number one target now, Betsy, so
Where
it's going to get really interesting in Iowa.
Wear it as a badge of honor. You've got airtime on this show anytime. And let me just say in closing to all of our friends who are listening, this is a critical election coming up in November because our freedom, our U.S. Constitution, our values are under attack. Tomorrow I'm going to be focusing on some of the blue state governors who are up for re-election, and particularly Daniel Malloy of Connecticut, who has eviscerated the Second Amendment, driven jobs out of Connecticut, kowtowed to the public unions, and taxed the middle class to the bone. We'll be talking about the Connecticut race, the New Hampshire races, and many others ahead. And then looking ahead to 2016, let me just say this. We live in the freest country in the world. But 2016 is a test. We must elect a president who will repeal Obamacare, rein in government spending, and more than anything, respect, honor, and defend the United States Constitution. That is our mission. Today is We the People Wednesday. Let us all celebrate our freedom. It's wonderful to be with you, and today we can recommit ourselves to taking a stand one by one to make sure that this greatest experiment in human freedom continues. It was 225 years ago this month that the federal government was launched under the United States Constitution. Let's keep this Constitution. It is a great gift to humanity. Thank you, Betsy McCoy, signing off. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the voice of freedom, Laura Ingraham, on your healthy radio addiction. Yeah.